Is everybody about ready to get started in Las Vegas?
Okay.
It's a pretty room.
I haven't been to the building yet.
You need to go.
I know.
Come on
in.
You're a
big wide off.
I know. I know.
I'm going down on the 15th and the 16th to do a training with Legal Aid and the Regional Center on Texas County Council, so I have to go by.
We need to show you around down there if you enjoy that.
I watched it, you know, and then I knew.
Yeah. Okay, I know Sharon is still distributing some things. There were some supplemental documents distributed this morning. Did everybody get copies?
Not yet. I'm
going to
have them all around.
Okay. Let's finish that process, and then we'll be going. Let me do a roll call if we may. Deborah Ayers. Kim Burkholz. Elizabeth Frickfield.
Yes.
Mary Bryant.
Yes.
Kate Cavalera.
Yes.
Jennifer Richards.
Yes.
Linda Hastia.
Yes.
Lynn Hughes.
Yes.
Michael Keane. Karen Kelly.
Yes.
John Michelson.
Yes.
Judge Ochoa.
Yes.
Kelly Register.
Yes.
Andy Reed.
Yes.
Jennifer Salem.
Yes.
Ben Sturman.
Yes.
Ben Walker.
Present.
Paula Woodrow.
Present. I'll
pick up
the W.
Okay. Others present, Kate McCloskey.
Yes.
Sharon Coates.
Yes.
Mallory Nelson.
Yes.
Robin Sweet.
Yes.
Sabrina Sweet.
She's not going to be able to send.
Okay. Riley Wilson.
Yes.
From Carson City, if your name was not called, would you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Cassandra Jones. I'm an attorney in Madrid.
Hi, Cassandra. Okay. And in Las Vegas, if your name wasn't announced, could you please introduce yourself slowly? I'm taking notes. This is bad. Hi, Barbara. Anybody else? Okay. Welcome, everybody. We have a sizable agenda, so I don't want to waste people's time. We'll get through a number of these items quickly, and then we'll get into the overall meat of the agenda. Let me begin by asking if there are any objections or edits to the meeting summary of April 26th. All right, hearing none, does everybody approve those minutes? Say yes or no? Yes.
Yes.
Okay, a couple of abstentions then. Okay. And then May 16th, are there any edits to those meeting summaries? All right, hearing none, they approve?
Yes.
Anybody opposed? All right, anybody abstaining from the May 16th meeting? Okay, yes, Deborah Homer and Jeff Walker. All right, couple of quick things. First of all, the Supreme Court, as you know, had a public hearing on the proposed rules and forms. They extended the comment period to this Friday, August 3rd. At least as of 5 o'clock Friday night, there was no additional comment received beyond that which we already knew about. The court held a couple of conferences last week, and I'm in the process of preparing an order to approve both the rules and the forms, which I'm hoping the court will approve shortly after the August 3rd cutoff date. So the goal is to make these effective October 1st. Hopefully we'll be off and running at that point. There was an acknowledged correction by Mr. Berthold. That form will be corrected then as requested. Other than that, I think we're pretty good shape. And so that pretty much covers the status of where we are with the rules and forms. We'll get into other rules later in the meeting. Stephanie McDonald is now on double time probation, so she's no longer sentenced to rule the form. I wondered though if anybody had any questions or comments about the public hearing or about the form. Yes.
Homo Wisdom, for the record, I was really glad that you mentioned on the record just the privacy in the hearing. Gratitude to Stephanie McDonald, who worked very, very hard, and I just wanted to echo that I was there to pop up and mention her if I had to, and I didn't need to, so thank you.
Well, her service to the commission, and more importantly, her service to the state here has been extraordinary. And I really appreciate her work as well as that entire subcommittee. Did a fantastic job, and I think it's going to be a tremendous help to those who are in need of working through this process, and the forms will help them do that. So, we'll get into the rules when we get into another tab in the agenda, but I assume that there's no further comment or questions about rules that were presented to the court, at least at this juncture. Yes,
thank you, Mr. Tennessee. I was just wanted to say that I do have a draft letter of my oral comment that I circulated to them, and I'm trying to resolve that down and we'll be submitting it.
Okay, great. That's on the rules?
It's on the form. No objection to the rules.
Okay, all right, so then we'll look forward to that. Yeah, I would like, Jim, if you could, when you get that, if you could. Get me a response within a few days or so. Okay, great. That would be helpful. The process for adopting forms and rules in the Supreme Court now involves the clerk staff attorney. So they go through all this and make sure that I's are dotted, T's are crossed. It's a pretty exhausting review, and that becomes exhibit A for the order, and in each case. So we want to make sure that we've got it right when we issue those orders if we can. We'll talk on the piece of the agenda. We'll talk about the statistical reports from the second and the eighth, and then we'll get into some introductions and reports from the case. And then after that, we'll talk about the rules subcommittee, and then following that, I want to get into issues surrounding the 2017 legislative amendments and whether or not people feel that we should catalog any modifications or changes to the existing legislation, the amended legislation. And then finally address what our work program should be for the commission over the course of the next 6 months. As part of the report from Kay, and then as we get into the legislation, I've asked Kay and her office to do some research on the recording fees and the status of those. And then I've asked Legal Aid and Center of Southern Nevada, as well as Washington Legal Services, to inquire into the provisions for appointment of counsel in those in all of the counties and the status of that. And would invite Chief Buckley to comment about what's been taking place in Washington County when we get to that point. And we'll take it from there. So there may be some further changes needed in the fee issues or not, depending upon how the counties are pushing. So that's an outline. Let's first open it for public comments. I know Cassandra is here, and you may have a scheduling issue. If you don't, you're welcome to stay as long as you are able to, or if you want to provide some additional comments now, that's also fine.
Your Honor, I have to be moving at 1:30, but other than that, I have no
time. So. Great. Then you're welcome to interject. I know there's a couple of things that involve some emails and letters and so forth, and we invite your input when we get to that point. Any public comment in Clark County, Judge Sherman? You see anybody there with any public comment? Okay, great. Then let's turn to Ms. Nelson and Mr. Wilson about statistical reports. We'll start with the second district. Mallory, you ready to go?
Yes, Mallory Nelson for the record. At previous committee meetings, specific to the second judicial, it was identified and prioritized that as part of our default milestone tracking, we would add specific votes for the bond, a blocked account, or if it was raised, be able to track why that was raised. So effective June 25th, we do have going forward for cases filed after that date, June 25th, as a result, it will add a bond or blocked account as part of the automatic milestone. We also are able to, a secondary note message management system, able to capture if it was waived, do a very specific test, the specific reasons why it was waived. With respect to cases filed before the new test was implemented, that is the subject of manual review. Those milestones are added. So the data, while it is limited at this juncture, we will continue to develop that as time goes on. The commission also prioritized data on our number of detected cases. Again, effective June 25th, we identified a specific hearing code with which we could code matters that are on petitions to appoint a guardian objected to. And that hearing code is then specified as a contested hearing. We do not have that retroactively added to cases before that June 25th date. So prior to that date,
users are not able to automatically pull that data through the case management system. However, going forward, we will be able to pull the number of our contested matters. The second piece of focus was also effective May 4th of this year. We changed the policy that would require the subsidy to check regarding who was getting in case. Now those petitions may continue to be filed in the same case. So I want to highlight adult guardianship. Our number of active cases has held somewhat steady at 938. And as Walter can also speak to in more depth, our minor guardianship numbers.
No, I think what we'll do is ask if all the commissioners are provided with the rather detailed report, and I'll invite questions in a moment. Said Walker, did you want to add anything with respect to minor guardianship numbers?
I'm happy to report, this is Eugene Walker for the record, I'm happy to report that after a couple of years of scrubbing, I think we can confidently say there are 983 cases involving 1,157 children, or 1,175 children, excuse me, in the district. There remain about 60 children that Ms. Sweet has been beginning the dialogue with the statewide case compliance officer to find. I know through school records and other records, we've been able to locate those children, and so I'm remarkably proud of the work that Ms. Sweet and Ms. Nelson and the judges in the second have done. The only thing the only other note I would emphasize, Justice Hardesty, is if you look at page 4 of 17 related to the minor guardianship cases, the minor guardianship cases continue to trend sharply up per year. So in 2017, there were 281 cases. And if you look at the monthly filings on the previous page in the new case filings for calendar year 2018, it would appear that that trend is going to continue for 18 as well. And it's just it's an interesting observation to me. I think it's reflective of the child welfare system in part because, of course, guardianship is one of the five terms you track for a child who's subject to foster care. I think it's also a statement of the economy, but it's also just pure numbers. I think as the economy continues to grow, those numbers are going to continue to grow and at a greater rate. And so we'll have to keep an eye on resources within the district for that.
And that, who's the minor guardian? Are you still performing those services, or is that been assigned to someone else?
Dick Humphrey was assigned those services. He, of course, is on suspension now. Schumacher has stepped in, but I suspect there will be some reshuffling, if you will, of those assignments going forward.
Let me ask if any of the commission members have any questions for Mallory regarding the minor guardianship statistics or the adult guardianship statistics. Yeah,
I'm a Wickham for the record. I noticed that the obviously more children than there are cases. Does that just date back to old cases where there were multiple children on a case number, and then we're going forward having one child per case number?
Mallory Wickham for the record, and that's also correct me if I'm wrong. I believe that was the case. I don't recall the year in which it was instituted one case per child.
2 years ago. We made the change, and that's exactly why there's a difference. There are continued to be those cases that have multiple siblings within a single case.
Any other questions for Ms. Nelson about the report from the second? I had a couple of questions, if I could. And would like to turn to page 9 of 21. This is the report from July 20th, 2017 to May 20th, 2018. call an alternate dispute resolution, the adult guardianship. And I was a little surprised by what I considered to be relatively low numbers, and wondered if there's something I'm missing there, or if the district still directly mediation in adult guardianship beyond this, because one of the questions that had come out of the previous guardianship commission was the importance of mandatory mediation. So I wondered if the numbers, if that's what's happening, and as a consequence, the mediations are not very substantial.
No, just for the record, generally speaking, that sets for extremely high conflict cases where an objection to the petition at a point is noted and it is set out for a contested hearing. Almost always the parties are directed to go to mediation. However, this data would not capture ADR efforts by the parties prior to coming for that first hearing. So that may be another piece that we captured and reflected in this data. Again, this is for a precise last 12 months, so some of our funds have fallen off as this is a rolling report.
But it does show the last 12 months, those are, that's about the extent of the
where
ordered. Okay. All right. And then it turns to 12 of 21. This is the appointment of counsel of the last 12 months. I wondered if, and I assume that not all of these are Washoe Legal Services, but maybe they are. But that was my question. The court appointed attorneys. Are these numbers reflective of those that have been appointed, luckily the services have been appointed?
So if you look starting about March through June, those numbers do fill in, and a couple of factors drive that. One of which, because of particularities with our case management system, each court appointed attorneys added individually, so it would not be Washoe Legal Services as a group, it would be the attorney that is the Fisher, Richards, and Evans. Upon filing a notice of appearance specific to each attorney, then that party is ended, and so that number goes down. Another factor driving the increase in the court appointments is the court is looking very seriously with respect to its youngest demographic population, ages 18 to 29, reviewing the ongoing necessity of the guardianship as it is, either in whole or in part. And as part of the court's scrutiny and in its commitment to administering guardianship in the most appropriate and consistent manner possible, that has also led to the appointment of Walker Legal, who is in counsel is then able to request further modifications if appropriate.
To existing guardianship?
Yes.
So these are not reflective of new ones. These are reaching out to Walker Legal Services to address existing guardianship.
And these numbers actually combine both. So the automatic appointment for both the new petition and then the existing
petition. But all of these numbers were still court appointed attorney, that's Washoe Legal Services.
That's correct.
Okay.
And this person?
Yes.
Just as a point of clarification, I'm not sure I realized that the statute required that, but after one case, I realized it was pointed out that the statute requires appointment of Walker Legal Services or the legal services in that area.
Correct.
And there's some lack of clarity on how that person gets an attorney other than Walker Legal Services. And I think that would probably come up in court if the person actually is able to step up and say, I want a different attorney or I have a different attorney. But there's not a lot of procedural depth in that position, that particular part of the statute. So there's some area that needs probably some attention.
Well, wouldn't in the course of the petition proceedings, if the protected person was able to, or if a family member or others wanted different counsel, why wouldn't they raise that with the judge?
Family members have raised it, and it wasn't considered the protected person's opinion, and that's why there's some probably more depth that needs to be explored in that statute.
Well, maybe we can get into this when we talk about the arbitration, but I'm not sure what you have in mind. This is a judicial decision at that point, so if a family member goes in and requests a change of counsel, isn't that a judicial decision to change counsel?
I guess what I'd say is that in some of the provisions of the statute where there are preferences, it says that family members can come in and request, to be preferred. There isn't anything that allows the family members to come in and ask for a private attorney to be appointed, even if they've arranged to have one that they pay for. And so, well, an attorney is hired, a person that entered their appearance, and the question became, is that appropriate or not? And there was some indication that that's not allowed by the statute. The argument was that was not allowed by the statute. I will provide some copies of those provisions and information to the court so that that's something we can look into.
I'd like to hear from, let's defer this, so we get into the substance of this, but I'd like to hear from the lawyers and the judges handling these matters. It would seem like if someone files a notice and a request for the appointment of counsel and they're referring to a preference of some kind, the judge should adjudicate that. Okay. I'd also like to go to page 17 of the report. Just an observation. I was surprised to see the age breakdown. 46% of the guardianships are under 21 and 18, presumably through age 39, and then 35% age 60 through 99. Rather interesting breakdown. Most of these cases are coming from either end of the spectrum.
The proportionality of young people entering the guardianship system at a rate with individuals more elderly with more degenerative conditions, typically dementia, Alzheimer's, that is of notice and of concern to the court, and was another factor in determining to pursue appointments of lawful legal services on these communications with respect to young people.
So what I was wondering about is in the 46% category, is this being driven by substance abuse and principles?
I actually don't have a data-driven answer to that question. We have previously received many referrals from the school district for very, very young people. Currently, the school district did work with the authorities on essentially some very similar to the 46 decision making form so that parents could continue to be able to assist and be a part of the IEP planning. And that was a significant reason they were coming into the guardianship court.
So I have the same question for your district as well as the youth. And I'm going to ask Riley this, but I'm guessing that these percentages are true in the loop as well. But if we need to explore the drivers of the guardianship involvement in this lower age group, substance abuse is impacting the entire judicial system in lots of different ways, but this is one that may not have been on everybody's radar screen except those that are in the business, in the stakeholder system. And I'm concerned about this age group having to have so much involvement in the guardianship system. Daniel, you were going to comment? And
I do, and I can only comment out to the public guardian situation in this area, which are a high proportion of the public guardian's caseload, and they are predominantly substance abuse cases and mental health cases. Individuals who are otherwise not able to be served by the mental health community, guardianship is often thought as a way to essentially lock these people up when the mental health community has stepped away for reasons that are establishing case law, but unfortunately, guardianships are now looked at to do what cases like Olmstead have prevented the mental health community from doing, and the DRU also applies to public entities across the board. But it's a very difficult population that's underserved, and guardianship seems to be the next venue for substance abuse, mental health, and homelessness.
So I was going to ask Mallory, I don't know, you guys are wizards to produce all of this data, and I'm so amazed by it, but I think that it would be really productive if there was a way for the second and the eighth and maybe other districts to capture the drivers of these guardianships. What are the reasons expressed in the decision for guardianships in this age group? And then with that data, we might be able to express the adverse impact on the system as a whole, and perhaps look at some alternatives to preventing this, or at least using it in a different way than school guardianship in the system.
This is Mary Bryant. Just speaking because I've had a lot of involvement with the school district, and they are so telling people often when they turn 18, you have to stick on anything, or you won't be able to help your student at all. And while I'm thrilled that they're looking at support decision making, the way that this school district, at least here, runs is that a lot of times the stuff at the top, like the special ed department, does not get down to the principal and special ed, you know, school level. So, I mean, I think that's a big issue.
Okay. Yes,
Ms. Carmen?
This is for this is something we've been talking about here as well. There, I believe, are a number of things dealing with families who think that regardless if they don't support a family member, they get rent. Usually, credit card usually, usually get the rent. And there's a bunch of ways to do it on the street. And we'll say, you know, on the street, they need to find a job, they need to introduce you to the treatment program. We don't have a mechanism to do that. I think we need an urgent program for that. And I'm happy to Bellman talk about how we can integrate that into our existing mental health part. Because there's no incentive. We just look very internally and turn filling into the treatment program, you know, the criminal charges. We don't have any more there. And at first, what happens is we understand the guardianship is similar. So then we, and then we'll fall, and then we'll probably do better, but they don't seem to do the same. So I believe that we need some sort of diversion program for people who are simply needing to step on their legs. There's no reason they should be in the guardianship. There's nothing else wrong. And they have the right to not take their medicine.
Right. So what I was trying to do is build some statistical underpinning for this segment and then take a look at what potential solutions might be available, if any, as part of our work going forward this fall.
I'll send you information on programs from Texas and Ohio.
Great. Thank you. That's great. Jed Walker.
A request I'll make through IT, just part of you will be to ask how many of our minor guardianship cases are matriculating into adult guardianship cases as well, so we can understand that supply trail, if you will, consistent. And that would be, I would think, relatively easy to figure it out.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Nelson? Yes, Barbara?
Numbers in the minor guardianship, did it reflect the guardianship file under 132, the yellow form file under 159?
Yes, they do, because in our district, what happens is a new case number generates once the guardianship is granted. So the petition for one of the permanents who plans to do guardianship gets filed in the 432D case, but when the guardianship is invested, if you will, it has its own case under this tracking. So these numbers include that demographic. You're welcome.
Okay, any other questions for Mallory or Judge Walker? Yes.
Thank you, Heather. I had a question. What if a case has a bond and a blocked account? Is there a way to, do you have to track that? Do you think it's necessary? And presently, can you do that?
We would track both if both are ordered.
Okay.
We would reflect that both are ordered.
And you can do that. Okay.
Okay, Riley, we distributed, I hope everybody in Las Vegas has the report distributed this morning. It's fairly substantial. I was wondering maybe, since we just got this, Riley, if you could, go through this in a little bit more detail. Some folks just got it. Maybe you could highlight some points from some of the questions that were posed earlier.
Okay, the report is very available here. The minor report is on top, and then the adults are on the bottom. Unfortunately, we're not as far along as far as tracking some of the other additional students back to bottom of the last count. And so we're still working on that. And we'll continue to do so until we get all the information that is requested for if you want to go through step by step or
I guess the first question I had, let's go step by step, beginning with the pending minor guardianship cases. The second identified some 900 plus. Here you identify some 598, and I was wondering if I would have expected the numbers to be reversed given the size of Clark County. So maybe you could comment on that and comment about the status of the enormous amount of work I know that the judges have been doing along with the staff to scrub the numbers in minor guardianship in Las Vegas.
So we're still working on the minor guardianship, recovering part of that. As of this morning, there was 4,800 cases that were open or pending, or at least including the track. And so we do know a lot more than just what shows up in this report. Some of the reports, frankly speaking, I don't trust the numbers quite yet because it's a work in progress, and that this would be an example of that. I don't have an explanation of what that part means, but is exactly. So we do have more cases that we're working on studying, so we're paying attention to them. trying to get a hold of.
But you're, so the numbers of minor guardianships is around 4,800 at this stage?
That's correct.
Okay. I'm sorry, we couldn't hear the question or the response.
I'm sorry, I've asked if it included 4,300 guardianships, and the answer was that it was not.
Okay. Are those separately tracked, Riley, by someone else, or is your office looking at the 433 cases also?
Yeah, we haven't been looking at them. I'm not as familiar with those, but my guess is probably not a good track to go out there.
Okay. The minor guardian page 4 of your report, do you have confidence in these numbers at least for 2016, 17, and 18 for filing?
Yeah, those are the accurate numbers of what they have.
So it looks like if the trend continues in 18, you're going to have the same issue that exists in the second district, where you're going to exceed 1,100 plus, maybe 1,200.
Right.
Okay.
And these numbers in the start are as of the 30th of June, so yeah.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
And basically, the different numbers, the types of cases are there, and it's listed out and what the individual case subtype is. And the point is, man, so we can have an idea of what's being reported there. Usually, we have a temporary list, so we can see the subtype, but that's still going to be accurate. So.
What is meant by the fact that there's no subsite description? Is that just an omission in the order, or in the
Well, coding? Sometimes what happens is the case will be, what's the right word, just the case type is put in as a minor guardianship when it's really a guardian of item. And so it really should have been put in attached to another case altogether, not in the guardianship part of that one. And so we're working on that, but that would be one example of you can't really put a case subtype down as a guardian of the person of the state because the reporting requirements would be the same.
And then you get into the adult guardianship.
This is still, that's a typo on my part of the year, but this is still a minor report over another 10, 13 pages or so.
Alright.
So that's just where the closing numbers of the USDR. I'm just going to move on if anyone has questions as always. Skip to the next page 7 of 19. This is another one where I know there's not in the last 2 years 3,000 cases been filed, so probably I don't know why the exact number is there, but I know that there's not 3,000 that have been out. So over 80 days without being murdered or dealt with. The temporary ones, I don't know how many off the top of my head temporary ones are filing minors and last for greater than 80 days, but I'm also assuming that that is multiple times the extended as well, so that number can be very huge depending on how it's being. So those are things we'll be working on signing up for the next report, so we know exactly what they are and what they need and that stuff. Again, the alternative, the receiver needs to be mediated from several of the conferences, so we're just a work in progress. These are the only ones that popped up. Maybe the lawyers in the room are starting to contend if there's more of that happening than is being reflected in the report. I don't know. We're still working on a way to answer that in our engagement.
Ms. Thurman, is
Jim
Clark using mandatory mediation?
I'm the judge in the law, which is that reminder.
Results, and that's the comment. most of the adult information I feel pretty confident about, I'm working out of volunteers and you can go through and see the training and see what the important is. Some of the questions that you already asked, we're still working out on the bond, and so it's not going to be in the report to show how many are out there, and a bond is maybe waiver bond, and we don't have those reflected yet. We're still working on gathering that information. You know, the flip through the same, a lot of the same information, and you know what you're, I don't know if you need to address it, adult alternative to TV information or seminar conferences. We don't have the way to track those yet, the specific information on it. I don't know if.
I did want to refer back, if I could, Riley, to page 2 of the adult guardianship report. The number that stood out to me was 19 pending active temporary guardianships. My question for Jeff Sherman, that suggests that temporary guardianships in adult cases have really dropped considerably in the district. Is that your sense, Judge?
Correct,
yeah. Okay. And then I noticed as well that new case filing, we're clipping along relatively consistently, about 64 or 5 per month, somewhere in there.
Yeah, this year it looks like we'll be on par with the last few years, right in that same ballpark. For new cases.
With regards to the special learning, so on page 5, we have a special learning thing on the special learning person says, we have a different subject. We didn't have the same criteria for reporting because you have to use the voice email anyway. So then you'll have to, if you're going to do a thing and you're not done to maybe be getting all of the information, you may not be up for a year. You still track. And then it is going by the degree. What does it depend on what's in the order?
Those ones, samples are a little bit more difficult. They're not tracking the same. They have a bigger recovery as the other ones. So we do keep an eye on them and do look through them to see if somebody has been out there for a while, then we're in contact and say, hey, what's going on? And we can see what we do. And those are in. Coming in from out fairly quickly. Do you have any other comments on that?
Yeah, we typically file the county and inventory and all the samples we use. In some cases, where there's been no access and any documents or anything like that, we may have just not viewed that one around here, but pretty far in the middle. There's always a, if we did have any access money in the action, so we think that if we wanted to, we had no access, no possession test year control, or if we did, then we'd do inventory. So we always do inventory, but we'll do it in the county as well.
Most of these specials are done with lawyers involved, and from what I'm seeing, pretty good about filing everything like that. So we can get that picture. Usually it's with the private professional branch as well, and so they're being looked at by the other branches of the game, and so it's happening, but we're not tracking it as closely.
And then I just wanted to clarify the thing for this, that if you go to the hearing, not when the order's filed, but what everyone's doing,
for taxing my other inquiry to with a vacation note rather than an order or something.
What is that?
I'm going to order. I thought it was going to turn that you don't get it from a
when we look at them, sometimes we get the owner's record specifying date. And if it's specifying, then that's the date we use.
Can I get a little bit of a story? It's just any kind of confusion. So if there's a series of names and they got ordered there, the guy would get, but then sometimes the order may not be filed. Yeah, and that would be because the thing is too long.
That may be an area of your honor that could use clarification to whatever they don't say maybe, so maybe it's not an issue at all. I'll just do that, okay.
Well, it certainly sounds like it could be. I mean, it should be consistent. I'm assuming in a second you're operating from the order.
That's correct.
Yeah. The delay in the eighth is just the delay from the hearing to the order getting to the judge. So that's what you're talking about, is that period of time?
Most of the time, my understanding is signing in court is filed. Is that most 90% of the time?
Okay.
That you refer to is the one thing.
Well, without the order, you can't function.
That's true.
It seems to me like it ought to run from the order.
That's been the policy in the past.
Well, we were concerned that, and one of the things that had come up previously was that it seems to be taken over and someone has filed the letter that were ordered appropriately. We still want to see, at least to go back to the rule, even if you filed it, you had, if you were doing it, technically, it could have been having access to money, but it really didn't file everything you needed to. But therefore, we didn't do anything.
Home origins for the record. I think that when Judge Steele was handling the case, he was adamant that it was the hearing date, and I think that's where we were getting our information in part, because when you were inheriting a case where someone didn't exactly know what they were doing, when they had gotten their guardianship order 2 weeks later, when they got around to going to the courthouse, and the system needed a way, we thought, to track that, were those cases where someone else started with the temporary guardianship, became a general, then public guardian comes in at some later date, and they were wondering, what is the anniversary date for purposes of annual accounting? Is it the date they were made temporary? Is it the date they were made general? Or is it the date the public guardian became the guardian? And so then there was some confusion about compliance, if I'm correctly stating that.
Well, I'll defer to Judge Sherman on that. I mean,
Yes, I did take it in the form that lists all the reports that are due and the dates that are due. And if they walk out of court with signed orders, that form populates the students based on their hearing. And most people walk out of their hearing with a signed and filed order in their hearing. So the separate is automatically populated with the hearing date, and there is a decision date, and an anniversary date in the state, and that decision is always your longer. Occasionally, when there's something that needs to be added to the order, and you don't have it ready for them, or counsel don't have it ready, and they have to fix it, then that's it for them. But for our purposes, we put in a decision date to be the date.
So, Judge, when the order is signed later, is there some form that populates those dates, and is that provided to the parties?
And now, if you do have a different one, we will.
Well, I think we should take direction from how you and the judges in the agents are handling this as to how you prefer the matter to be handled.
This is Judge O'Shaw. This will be a hearing date, and the reason
it's like you were saying, is most of the time they walk all the way to order, but the other problem is, I don't want anyone playing the rules when they're laying the order and they're laying things that are going on. And you have a baby that says, really, you know, they have to wait for this, and it's going to be 60 days down the road, we'll be in for it.
Well, it seems like since the cases are few in number and the instances in which it happens are unique, you know, run from the hearing date, that seems like the better policy in the way. Since the hearing date and the order, it sounds like in the vast majority of cases are the same anyway. Okay, Ryan, go ahead. Page 11 of 16. We have since July 2017, 317 cases assigned to counsel for protected persons in the age. Are those all the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada?
So since about in January, we've been supplying a list to the Legal Aid Center, and so that is fairly consistent with that number being appointed. There could be others appointed that are not, but that's going to be the center exception. I'm not aware of any, but that doesn't mean there aren't any out there.
Okay. And what I'm looking at here and in the second as well is to try to compare notes and make sure that the numbers are the same for the legal aid center in Southern Nevada as well as the aid district records, and then do the same thing in the second. We owe a responsibility to the legislature to address appointed counsel and how many were appointed and the like, and I want to try to button down these statistics so that the legal aid organizations are reporting the same number of appointments that the courts are reporting. So between now and the next time we get into this, I would ask that Mallory up here and you, Riley, down there, reach out to the legal aid groups and compare notes and numbers to see if these figures compare.
Okay.
Barbara, did you have a question, Barbara?
Just a comment. I wonder if the adult number is the minor appointment number is accidentally included in the adult number. So there's 317 on both. And our number is as of June 30th, we are representing 766 protected persons. And on October 1st, when the registration was effective, we were at 228. So we are currently accepting appointments on every new division and every problematic division. And we have to apply to our court.
That includes minors?
No, that is only adults. However, in regards to 432, we are in interest, and that's why we have to ask. We are currently representing about 3,000 children in the child welfare system. So every time one of those cases results in a minor guardianship, as the method of finance is, we are representing the child on all of those cases.
Do you represent one of these at the hearing?
We represent them now. We are representing about 85% of the children in the child welfare system, and our goal is by January 1st to achieve 100%. So we are representing them through day one with the permanency plan, just guardianship. We will assume that child in the home, in the guardian's home, represent the support for the child one. We are at every hearing, fully filing decisions if necessary, objecting on the death of the minor guardian, it's a full representation model.
Mr. President, so the only reason I have heard in some cases that SARR is 132 deeds, and there's no alternative to hearing for the child.
If the new legislation was passed, they put forth that the deadline number is 132 we are staying on all of those cases in the child welfare action. The next, I think, area to tackle for council is my guardianship. What we don't do with the plan, and so that's why the data is really helpful when we begin to analyze that. A long story, yes, we're happy to work with Riley and Georgia for the next commission meeting to make sure that data aligns.
Chris, Taylor, did you have a comment you were going to add?
I had a question, I also have a comment. I can also go back to our office and look at our data for Carson Lyon and Douglas. We also represent protected persons in those counties as well. But my question was on the temporary guardianship for Riley and Mallory. Are we tracking the data of when these temporaries is put in place to when it becomes granted or continuation, or does that data get subsumed in general? We don't know if that case started as a temporary.
It's not an open to the record. We are able to pull based upon the hearing code whether there was a temporary, it was extended, and then resulted in a full permit.
Riley, did you hear the question up here by Jennifer?
I think so. So when we have temporary guardianship, then I'm not sure how that's tracked. I know we tracked it, and I know we know what it is when the full guardianship starts, but I'm not sure that there's a note on the case when it came from.
Okay. And in Washoe, Judge Walker did the same process existing in Washoe where Washoe Legal Services is on the 430 CD and it gets transferred over to a guardianship they stay on the case?
No, they're actually taking the minor guardianship appointment, and so I don't want to overstate it, but if we don't need to go back to report, but they're taking north of the 80 appointments already this year in the minor guardianship action, with the goal again being that every child has an attorney appointed, and that was the funding stream that you worked so hard that we were able to take advantage of. They also, Washoe Legal Services, represent the children in the 432B case as well. But the goal is 100% representation of the children.
I think, Judge, we're going to get into this a little bit later in the program, so to speak. But the goal that has been set by the legal aid organizations that are providing representation to minors is to try to make sure that the minors are represented 100%. And use the child increase portion of the fee that was a county discretionary fee increase to fund that. So in your case, hopefully we'll be able to move in that direction in Clark County. Does that make sense? There were basically three separate funding sources in that legislation. One assured the appointment of counsel for adult guardianship. Another allowed for the appointment of investigators in minor guardianship. But a third funding source was directed at providing counsel for children in all child cases. And so the point is that there's some guardianship carryover in many of those cases, as Ms. Buckley was explaining, and I'm thinking the same is happening in Washoe Legal Services as well. So the question then is, how do we extend the use of those funding sources to help assure representation of proposed minor protected persons out of that source? Kind of a roundabout way of getting at the same thing. Mm-hmm. Yes, Barbara.
Just to clarify, the timing of that is later. So the funding source for children for Clark County was only for children in child welfare agencies, child welfare system.
Right.
It's not for the other timing that are just in the minor guardianship. And that is not the budget. mothers and unborn girls unrepresented children in child welfare system. So I really look forward to the discussion on council now, that council for those children and the land guardians of action is absolutely a high priority.
Okay. Any other questions for Riley? Thank you. Was going to make a comment? Or
yeah, I just wanted to, going forward, there could, in fact, as alluded to by Shirley Register, there could be a situation where private counsel is appointed for a proposed protected person, and make, so we can make sure that we have adequate statistics for the legislature to fund the legal aid program. Is there a way to break those out on your system? You know, we have four private lawyers, they're paying, they're seeking money coming out of the awards estate, if we're paying them a fee. The rest of the people are being paid by legal services. I mean, are we going to have to do that, or can we do that?
Chris Mallard,
currently
in the second, whether that attorney is worked for legal aid or whether it is the judge from the bench pointing to Mr. Cavalera 4266 cases, those are coded as different party types, court appointed. So we currently do not have a distinction in our party type between is that court appointed a attorney in legal aid or a private attorney.
Could we?
I'll have to follow up with that.
Okay, I make a request to you and Riley both to see if that's possible. Because I think as we work toward reconciling the numbers that the legal aid organizations are receiving versus what the courts are appointing or showing in their records, we're going to have to clarify that at some point. Yes, ma'am.
I have a follow up question for Mallory. For example, law for legal services was court appointed, and then private attorney was the substitute in. Would that be tracked the same way, or would that be tracked differently?
It would be, what is that, I think, to make sure I understand the question. In terms of, like, would it still show that a court appointed attorney,
when the private attorney substitutes in, that they would be marked by a different identifier.
That is correct.
Yes. So our, if I can speak for law for legal services, our general opinion of the statute is that it requires first a legal aid appointment, and then a judicial determination if the person wanted to retain or have to get their own counsel bill.
Back to the point earlier, the judicial decision. Okay, all right. Any other questions for Riley on statistics?
This is Mary Bryant. I just had a question. I don't know if it's all the data or what, but on page 13 of the children's report, the annual report of the guardian, they're 55% are non-compliant compared to the adult ones on page 12, which is only 9% non-compliant. Is that that we aren't able to track it, or that we... We just don't know what's going on with these kids.
Just to the adult fire is going to be active. The minors, we're still working on the job, which includes making sure that
any other questions? So I just wanted to announce that in Clark County we have 16 judges doing the minor guardianship. Probably 2 weeks ago we have gone from 16 judges to 2 judges doing all the minor guardianship. And Cliff Harder and myself will be doing the minor guardianship. And I think that way we'll be able to work a little closer with minors and by different numbers that we have been concentrating on adult guardianship for the past 2 years and trying to catch up on minor guardianship.
I was glad to see the district move to that direction. All right, this sermon, you had a, we had listed you on the agenda here under item U, an update from you on whether cases filed in the patient's bill of rights statute would be heard in general jurisdiction of family court.
Yes, I did learn it from the records. This came up as a question of where to direct the patient. There's been no jury exposition to the human patient and very ministry of the family of the medical school and the medical school. This is not part of the system, but it's in there. And if you have a decision or as a certain unless there's learning that is involved in that, when the just as the new city
did Judge Gonzalez or does Judge Bell have a viewpoint from a case management standpoint on this subject?
Because it's all about it. Because it's all about it.
have a point, but my problem is you're going to have to have a sticker. This is actually the way it is now. You're going to have to have a guardian.
So what I'm going to do is refer this subject to John and Danya. I think it should be handled by rule, and I think we should draft a rule that would direct these matters to the guardianship judge. And then we can draft this to the commission and roll this out in the next round of rules.
I don't have to know.
As a statewide issue. Okay?
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Foskey, you have a couple of these staff you might want to introduce, although they mentioned their names earlier, and then I'll have you go forward with your report.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, yeah, we have to hire two additional staff who are located in Las Vegas. So, Bonnie Jones, she's hiding from the camera here. There's our intake financial specialist. And then we have Lord Cassie, Carol, who's our investigator. We're so fortunate to have these two ladies. Sonia brings a great background in bank examination and fraud. And Cassie is a social worker and some sort of Elder Protective Services. So we're very excited to have them and get them busy and work.
Great.
Okay, as for my report, I did submit a written report, so I'm just going to kind of give you some highlights from it. As of June 30th, we had 52 either audit or investigations that we were ordered into from six different district courts. Throughout Nevada, we closed 36. We're actively investigating or auditing 14. We're monitoring 2 where reports have been submitted, but we haven't closed them out yet because we have some ongoing action and activity that we might need to be involved in. Our average length of investigation, the average time is 30 days to complete thus far. The hotline, we received about 25 calls so far from it. The majority of them are not related to guardianship, but people need resource navigation to various social services agencies. So we provide that type of service. Joseph Privacy has asked my office to do research and reporting fees as it relates to counsel for protected people and minors. So we are drafting up a survey that we'll be sending out to parties. We will also include in that survey the $1 recording fee for investigators that could just added in and get all that information at once. So currently there are 5 of 11 counties that are collecting fees for legal services for children who send abuse in their buses. Washoe County is charging $6 fees. Clark 5, Churchill 6, Lyon 3, and Churchill 2. And then we'll be sending out surveys to get more information that hopefully at our next commission meeting I can use.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Foxy? Yes.
Hold on with this for the record. Are you having the SUPTA hotline with Pages Nevada 211 and Interconnection as a resource that can go to them?
We will be in that.
Okay, so the Community Governmental Assistance. So for those who may not know, we have 911, 311, and 211 is meant to be a number that people can remember and call and be directed to resources, navigation. So they're meaning for it to be really robust, but it can only be as strong as the data that's submitted to it. They can't seek out resources and bring them in. They're required by their grant structure to have resources go through a serious vetting process. So if organizations or resources or services want to be part of it, they have to reach out to 211 and complete those forms. So I thought I'd just mention it because it's really important since we're advertising heavily 211. We want them to get to the correct hotline if they're possible calling by guardian organization.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Fox?
There was county money for investigators for minor cases.
Yeah.
I was wondering if there was going to be a guideline so parties know what investigators to use, whether it's the city or county, and minor studies for cases.
Yeah, the purpose of this exercise is to pin down what the legislature authorized, determine what counties are collecting it, and how it's being accounted for. The $3 and the $1 fee for appointment of the adult counsel and the investigator fee, I'm concerned may be lost in the general fund of county's black hole. That was not the intent, and the legislation specifically requires you to use for a particular purpose. So we want to get our arms around what we have. Then the other issue, of course, is this other $3 fee for child representation. That was elective. Some counties have adopted it, some in the full measure and some less so. So we want to get our arms around that as well. But to get to your question, Judge, we want to know what's happening with that so that we can help the judges direct the use of those services and know who to appoint. I would say that in the interim, if you have investigative needs, you should reach out to the compliance office to assist you. And the two office members down there that are sitting across from you, they're very talented and they're ready to dig in and chase people down. And I know that in the north, the second judicial district put a big ask on the compliance office when they said to find 172 of our kids, I think it was. So they've been doing that, and I'm sure the folks in Clark can do the same.
And I just wanted to say that in Clark County, I understand the county has $497 an hour for the investigators. We don't have investigators yet, so, and I have been using the state office, and they've been very helpful.
Well, I do think that until the county addresses that, we may want to look at a memorandum of understanding, where perhaps the county can reimburse the state office for the use of investigators until the state figures out what to do. So I'll ask Kate this week to address that with the county manager. But I'm not going to let $450,000 sit in somebody's bank account until we show up next year at the legislature. If the state's going to be doing those investigations for minor guardianships, we should reimburse the state probably until they can get sorted out what they're going to do for an investigator. Maybe the county will appoint an investigator that you'll be able to turn to.
Well, I understand the county in Florida working to hire their own investigators.
Well, I think we should look at that so we don't duplicate efforts, so we ought to see how many cases are actually involved. So one thing I would ask, if you could, after you've conferred with Seth Potter, could you let us know roughly how many of those cases you predict you would actually appoint investigators for? I don't, Judge Walker, maybe you can check on Washoe's same thing. And I don't know what's happening in the rural counties. I'm not even sure all the judges know they have access to the investigator funds in the rural. So that's part of this process, is to educate the judges about this resource and get them to access it. The $1 fee is supposed to be segregated. I'm not sure that it has yet. So that's part of what Kate's office is doing, is drilling down into this and understanding where the funds are and who's spending it and for what purpose. And that's another issue about reconciliation. I've asked Kate to reconcile the dollar amount that are being paid out of the $3 fund for adult guardianship appointments versus what they received. I know that there's some contracts that have been entered into with Washoe Legal Services and some of the rural counties. I think there's even a contract in Washoe, but I don't know whether those contract payments match the dollar amounts that are coming out of the fee to the county. I'm not even sure if that's the case in Clark. I think Clark gets a direct disbursement of the fees. Is that right, Barbara?
That's correct.
So all of the fees at least in Clark are going directly to your organization, right?
Correct. And in fact, it requires that goes to the legal entity and not be captured by the court to the county.
Right.
So another reason why the survey will be very interesting to see where the money is landed in the rural community.
Right.
In Clark, we have received it directly.
And that's a good point, Kate. The 8th Judicial District has labored under an imposition of an administrative fee by the county on all kinds of fees that they're collecting that are to be used for the court. My question is whether or not, Vince, if you know or if we can find out, whether that administrative fee is being assessed on the $1 fee for minor guardianships in Clark, as well as whether the administrative fee is being charged on the child's fund. I assume that's not the case, Barbara, is that right?
The dollar investigator thing is segregated, and I go for the minor guardianships, and I have no knowledge of that whatsoever.
But the $5, I guess it was a couple dollar increase to your $5 for the children's project, is that coming directly from the county without an administrative fee also?
Yes, it is coming directly from the county without an administrative fee. Our county elected not to implement the full $3 as we've authorized by the last legislative session. So on the same one, to try to fight against inflation and try to file welfare cases. So instead, the commission authorized the $2, and the county is given as a separate contract $300,000.
Are existing in other counties. That's the thing that we're trying to sort out. I don't think they do. So I think Washoe Legal Services in the other rural counties, you have contracts out there. So
as far as I know, between Washoe and Carson, but we are providing civil provision on the separate.
Without compensation.
I believe so, but everywhere if I know, sorry, so exactly.
We're going to want to find that out now. Okay, so if I could, then we'll move on, unless there's any other questions for Kate or her staff. And Kate, I volunteered you to help Judge Ochoa, but I assume we're good to go there, right? Okay. You said yes, Judge.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you can't get her staff, use the hotline. No I want to interrupt the agenda. I received a call last week from Mr. Anderson, the Secretary of State's office, and he and his colleagues are present here. They signed in. I don't want them having to sit here on unrelated matters. So I wanted to interrupt the agenda and ask Scott to comment. He had called about this takes us back to the lockbox program. For those of you who will recall that, and some issues that the Secretary of State would like the Commission to look at and vet. So, Scott, if you don't mind, maybe you could come up here.
And
maybe stand if you don't mind, even right there, it'll be fine if you don't mind.
Oh, this is fine.
Okay, can you all see Scott?
Yes.
Okay, great. Go ahead, Scott.
Good morning. Thank you so much for coming here today. Thank you, Justice and Commission members. As we're getting ready for the legislative session in our legislative package, we've been looking at a few things, and there are several items that have come up relating to the lockbox and the appointment of registered agent for a non-resident guardian. I'm sorry, I have to introduce my staff. I'm Tim Karandi, our Deputy Secretary for Commercial Reporting, Lenora Mueller, who is our notary administrator, and down in Vegas we have Dale Anderson, who is our Southern Nevada deputy. So thank you so much. So we appreciate the great work that this commission is doing, and we are thankful we can be part of this in any way. In going through the legislation and the processes that were developed over the past couple of years relating to the items that I discussed, there are a couple of items that we want the commission to be aware of, and hopefully we can address these through legislation, and hopefully through legislation, the legislative package of the commission. Currently, the Secretary of State's office provides for the filing of a request to nominate a guardian form that allows a person to give his preference of a guardian of a person or a state, and the primary nominee and if desired to know an alternate. We received additional information along with this filing. We were just putting that information, whether or not it's really related to the guardianship nomination form, and putting it in the lockbox. We wanted to make sure that the commission is okay with that, and that met with your approval. And what I'd like to do at this point is turn time over just momentarily to Gail Anderson to explain a little bit more of what we're seeing in those lockbox files.
Okay.
Good morning. I'm Gail Anderson, Deputy President of the State for Southern Nevada. So, the lockbox was sufficient on January 1st of 2018 has gone very smoothly. The registered was prepared and ready to receive. As Scott mentioned, there is one area that has come up of individuals who would like to appoint co-guardians, and the current form allows, as Scott mentioned, for the primary and an alternate. So sometimes you're marking something out on the form and saying co, or supplying an additional piece of paper. These are just filing that. The only other thing that I would note is that we have 1,130 active registrants enrolled since January 1st. They're kind of fairly steadily and consistently. As other than just a co-guardian, that has been the main area that moving more than one person to co-guardian that has come up. So thank you. And we'll be working, I think, as they're supposed to. We have, of course, administrative contact registrants throughout the state. So if you have anyone can contact me, and I'll provide my
Thanks, Gail, for being here. Are you able to disclose how many have filed with the lockbox program?
Yes, we have 1,130.
Wow. Okay. Thanks for working on this with us. Really appreciate it. Nice to see you again.
Good to see you, sir. Thank you.
And the reason we bring this up is that if there needs to be a change to that form, allow for those that co-guardian or if you even do a service that information is changed on there, or if there's any additional information that you would like on those forms or allowable in the model.
Well, let's check. Does anybody have any questions for Dale or any concerns or issues with respect to the form in the lockbox? Yes.
There are the
and how are they learning about the law?
There was some initial outreach by a group of people that had been promoting and supporting this legislation. We also got a market, and I guess we can market through our Nevada Law Coalition, which is an after-rented program. So we have one Nevada Law Coalition, two registries now, which is an active registry, and the partnership registry. So on the website, a number of the law firms that have been in New York State County have been filing, have been filing and putting packages together. So we have been receiving it that way. So anytime the Office of Secretary will go down to Northern or Southern Nevada, business events, we take all of our materials on our road tours and clients there. And then we do have a program officer and myself, who is community values. We have a lot of civic groups, Swanson, different journalists there. We have physically done in Southern Nevada, which is where the one tax person is. But we can accommodate Northern Nevada as well as let us know in the new community what happens in that outreach.
Any other comments by commissioners?
I'm only looking for the record. I find it interesting, you know, people will make it their own, right? They'll edit the form, they'll change it, they'll add things. It's good for us to know, I think, with aging and disability, that there are maybe additional pieces of information, because I'm thinking if Elder Protective Services is maybe requesting information from your office, are we there going to get the whole packet, or do they need to request specifically all other documents, or will they just get that sheet, that first sheet, if they request information from you?
I'm Gail Anderson. The access to the law box is limited to court. And the member registers to one herself. And law enforcement, that's the court, I think you turn it over to obviously make them set up to have access before an employee is appointed. It requires a woman to set up a nominee to make sure someone wants to have access to. So, requirements will be all together. And so far, it has been like one sheet of paper that has another instruction that they're listed at that time. But it's not multiple pieces of paper. It's nothing like the directed filing where there might be power of attorney and really good all that. It's not a subject that there's multiple pieces, but everything is one requirement with the master.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. So I think there's a follow-up. If, you know, if I was throwing in something on a wish list, if there were going to be any legislative adjustments, I think that it might be beneficial to share this information with Protective Services, because often we have individuals who have declined, can't tell us who they may have nominated. It would be nice for us to contact that individual and ask them to step forward in the guardianship versus having to go to petition in the public guardian erroneously when they already had plans in place. I can kind of see a situation where work would have already been done in error against the person's wishes.
And I have a follow-up question, if I may. I don't know if maybe this is a question from Natalie or Riley. Courts are actually looking at this because the public guardian is petitioned by all sorts of entities and individuals. And one of the questions that always arises is there somebody who has priority of place statutorily or who is more appropriate to serve? And that information may be found in a law box. But of course, we would not know that, nor would the institution, so on and so forth, we're petitioning. So it's a good point whether or not the institution has the ability to find that out of actually doing it.
This is Mallory. So in the second, yes. Since we have had our institutional authorization to access our law box, we do check for whether or not that individual has a registered document. I would note it does depend, the interface that the court is looking at does depend upon having that individual's correct name and date of birth. And so those are just a couple variables that might affect the accuracy. I can report to date, I have not, through the lockbox, come across one of the nomination filings yet, but I strongly suspect that will change.
as time goes on and individuals, including you, like the lost dogs, may become aware of their journey.
Okay. I don't know about expanding access. When the lost dog program was debated by the previous guardianship commission, there was a lot of concern expressed about having anybody other than the protective person, the court, and law enforcement involved in accessing it. So I think there may be some issues there, but we'll hold that item open and come back to it. But Dale, while we have you here, if I may, would it present a problem to your office if that addition were made to the statute, so that as suggested by Ms. Woodrum?
Public guardian is an actual official, and I don't know if there's a problem. My concern 2 years ago when we discussed this was not intermingling in a way that directed medical side with the legal guardianship side. And that was the primary concern of creating the two federal law registers. It was not that it was that to cross over.
So if there was a way that the public guardian, if there was a need for the public guardian to that, I think it's something that we have. Okay. In terms of the
mechanics
in your office, though, would that present a problem?
No, not
with any. Okay. I'm sorry, was there another question in Clark County?
If you have a private attorney, let's say that they represent a facility that no one can afford help on, and they want to find out who the proposed designated people are, would they, I guess it's different, but would they have the ability to do that, or how?
No.
Okay. Okay, the same thing with hospital. Where you get an expedited order or something to be able to do that.
That's up to the court and not jail, but we'll appreciate that, John. Yes, Kelly?
I think that if Elder Protective Services was allowed to access that information, the hospitals often make a report to Elder Protective Services, and then they could coordinate then Elder Protective Services being a public agency would have access to that information and could help facilitate that without having a court order required.
Bottom line is, whatever the commission determines is appropriate, we would be able to allow that access. Again, it sounds like there's some further discussion that needs to be had on this matter, but the actual access, as long as it's approved by the commission, I don't think that that's going to change.
This may be an overbroad, Jennifer is Black Legal Services, this may be an overbroad exception, but generally people nominate someone in their powers of attorney, so to speak, so is there a process where they could report that through the LOCPLUS program? Is that a discussion that's being had, or are we requiring them to absolutely do an additional form on top of that?
I'll pass this on to Gail. There is concern with what we want to talk with legal counsel on. This is in regards to the certificate of acknowledgement of the notary public for this that is currently in NRS 159.0753. There's some language in there that lies in the face of the Uniform Law on Notarial Acts, if you want to. The phrase, I declare under penalty of perjury that persons whose names are subscribed to in the system and appears to be sound mind and undergo dress fraud or under influence. This comes dangerously close to the notary swearing a statement and notarizing their own statement, which is a violation of notary law under Uniform Law. We suggest that this statement be removed from the certificate that's currently provided. That act is inherent in the notary process. When a notary does their notarization process, they are to ensure that the person appears that they are not under the influence or of sound mind. But again, that statement kind of lies in the face of the Uniform Act. So we would be happy to work with
Let me ask if there are any commission members that have an opinion. Yes, Ms. Crisfield?
Those documents will be as well as the results of the
I think the answer, though, Elizabeth, is that to the extent that the attorney relies solely on the document, the will, or power of attorney, it may not be picked up in the lockbox, because the lockbox is very specific as to the designation. And the Secretary of State's office doesn't do a research on other stuff either. I mean, you request that stuff, they'll just give you all those records that have been filed with them. Is that right, Gail? So you're not going through and reading all of the wills or directives or whatever to determine their content. Absolutely. Mr. Anderson, who is the Deputy Secretary of State, underscored absolutely not. I think he's concerned about the Secretary of State's office giving advice about the content.
We don't give any legal advice, we don't do any legal review. This is strictly a ministerial function of inputting it into the law box and making that information available to the people that do have that authority.
Yes, Ms. Perlin?
Thank you, Mr. President. Look at that, you're saying in the notarial statements, now that I'm not going to realize, what I'm going to do is, what is this weapon? And then it's the office, and the language is in that statement, because the majority is certified, it seems, again, how would you do that if you are a representative doing
Thank you, Judge. We're in the process of completing the regulations surrounding remote authorization, and this has been a concern nationally as to, is there undue influence behind that camera? And this has been a national debate, and the comment has been, is there somebody with your kids out in the car while you're doing this in a notary, for a paper notary, a traditional notary? So it is something that we have concerns about. There are safeguards that are in place as far as the knowledge-based authentication and other means of authentication of the person that is signing a document electronically that we're looking at also. But this is, we're getting close to regulations, but we're still in the process of drafting those and working with the different vendors and the different states that are doing this also. We're one of, four states right now, Texas, Montana, and Virginia that are doing it. And again, we're in the final throes of putting together the regulations and the internal processes and web information. But that is a concern, and that's a concern afterwards, that they're also raising the concern that that can be done under the traditional notary law also. I understand that concern.
Your request is that the certificate of acknowledgement be removed as the current need.
Correct, and there's that one phrase, I declare under penalty of perjury that the person whose names are subscribed to this instrument appear to be of sound mind and under no duress, fraud, or any influence. That's adding an additional declaration by the notary, which basically has them notarizing their own declaration, which is problematic.
Just Chairman, other than the concerns about remote notarization, would you have an objection to the removal of that language?
Yeah.
Okay.
That would actually save a lot of heartache with the notaries, because there are a lot of notaries that will not notarize one of these documents because their counsel, and say if they're at a bank or at any other company that has notaries, they tell their notaries not to do these because of that one.
Do any commission members have any other comment, or does anybody object to the removal of that language on that form? All right. I think we might have agreement on that.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. And if I may, finally, in relation to the appointment of a registered agent for a non-resident guardian, we have a couple of concerns just regarding the process. Right now, if they just state that they will file as a registered agent pursuant to NRS Chapter 77, and there's some other things that we want some guidance on, or perhaps maybe give you some clarification. Tim Karani would like to give some comments about that.
Good morning. Okay, so the 2015 and 2017 sessions created this filing and then aligned it in Chapter 77 as far as the filing process and the fees and so forth. And it's working. It's working for us. There aren't very many of these. Today we have 134 of these on file. So I wouldn't expose this as a problem, but just maybe a question to you. What was left out was the maintenance of those filings. So if a guardian changes, or if a ward passes or whatever, there's no update or maintenance to those records. All we're doing is handling the appointments of the registry. So it's been a question that's come up a couple of times, and we've resolved it. If there's a court order, we'll always honor the court order and take care of our records that way. But I think what it brings up for you folks is that there's potential for duplication in the records. We do assign a unique identifier to each of these, and it's filed under the ward's name, but and I think the guardian's name is also in there. But if we just get a second filing because there's a change, we're going to record it that way as a second filing to go to the duplication.
Judge Berlin, Judge Walker, to the extent that you've dealt with these resident agent issues, what do you think about annual filing maintenance? I'm not sure what the Secretary of State has in mind. Would you notify the court of a failure to file, or
we don't know.
Yeah, we won't.
Because this is just an appointment. There's no mechanism in place to do an annual filing of registered meeting. If only if there is a change that may be ordered by the court, that may be a ward dies, if there's a change of that guardian, we would need some sort of notification from the court for us to change that, or some sort of notification by someone to make that change in that registered meeting filing. So it's more of a maintenance when there is a change in that garden.
Good sir.
All I really would ask them, if there's an out-of-state guardian, do
So in between, filing is available on our public search page, and I believe the statute for the bill talked about you using that as a resource. And so when there's no maintenance to that record, it's going to show as an active filing. So if the ward has passed, or if the guardian has passed, or whatever the case may be, our record won't change.
I think the part of you is the process is the court. So Mallory, as a part of her checklist, is managing that, and I think we, the judges, have to be proactive in our communication to the Secretary of State, and much before where we have to communicate, the courts have to report the firearms limitation, so we'll just have to add as a matter of process to our checklist, is, hey, I've got an out-of-state guardian, and they should have a registry, do they, and or the ward has passed, and so we need to make sure we communicate to the Secretary of State and let them know that that information is required.
That's something that you can do, Judge, in Las Vegas?
Sure.
Sure.
I think
that's
the
first
thing that
we
So, the community is a deficit. I know I've had a couple of things where I'll file that and we can miss all of them. But, you know, they're
not passing that. So, maybe Mr. Wilson can look into that as a part of the checklist that the judge needs to assess as part of that process, judicial process.
That's not a form, so, the community is adding a form.
Okay. Well, it's actually an out-of-state guardian. It might not be a lawyer. It might be.
Yeah, a lot of these are like
investments.
Anyone
has a time, even if they're out-of-state. Yeah. And they're pretty much John, did you have a question or comment? I'm sorry, Judge. I didn't mean to interrupt the video.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wanted to go back to the last five things. I don't want to interrupt the flow.
All right. Ms. Jones, did you have a comment or question?
So my office happens to be registered in here for at least three of those 146. And the process we use is when we're appointed, we file the registered agent form, but you're right, there's nothing after that. It's not like a corporate situation where once a year you have to re-up. So we do take it upon ourselves to file proof of compliance with the court. So the Secretary of State's office produces a file stamped copy for us and put that on record. But most of my clients, as the judge recognized, are out of state, are of limited means, an annual filing fee, which is further complicated the expense here. But it would be as simple as a dissolution or a change form that could be filed when we get discharged to the workers from a guardianship. I don't believe that it's appropriate to necessarily discharge the registered agent at the time of the protected person's death, because the guardianship is not actually concluded until the final accounting and the discharge. But I think those are akin to dissolution paperwork on the corporate side, and then it's what are the reasonable fees for often for families that have incurred extraordinary expenses in going through the guardianship process.
I think it's got from the point of view of the commission, keep filing them, and you'll get orders to tell you to get rid of it or not file it.
Well, we get court orders, we can file a tax court order.
That's good to know. There's a number of people who don't.
Well, and
I appreciate the point about movement. I think that's on the court system, not on your office.
Appreciate that. And with this issue, with any issue, with any of the processes, we're more than happy to be of assistance. We're here to help. We want to make this as efficient a process as possible, regardless of which process we're looking at, the lockbox, the major process. We're here to help. So please feel free to reach out to Deputy Anderson, Deputy Crosby, myself, Laura Mueller. And we will do what we can with them.
Well, Well, thanks to all of you, and thanks to the Secretary for being proactive on this matter. We really appreciate it. I think the one thing I would request consideration of is the Commission does not have any DVRs available to it. So if the Secretary of State's office were willing to include in its legislative package the removal of this language, I think the Commission would support it on this notice question. And that would ensure that that matter gets addressed. Now, before we go too far, I want to hear from John. He's circled back to the lockbox.
Just briefly on this, well, I just listened to the other benefit of having this great deal with the Secretary of State office. So, if any road was closed to another government agency who expect me not saying it wrong, who is it? Yeah, if there is a nomination, and then who they are, would that mean that I could reach out to the public guardian? Would you give me that information?
So that might be, John, something for the Rules Committee to set in the rules. I recognize your point. You don't want to go to a pretty extensive process to sort that out. So we need to figure out how to gain access to somebody who's in a petition. Well, there is one source, and that's counsel for the protected person. And as soon as they're appointed, they're in a position to acquire that information on behalf of their client. So, yes, thank you.
Just to follow that out, are you sending that to the counselors? And I apologize to the Secretary of State,
the point of my observation was, I can't imagine a lawyer who's been appointed for a protected person not asking the court for an order to access to find out who their guardian is supposed to be. You know, I would think that would be malpractice if you didn't do that. You're representing the supposed protected person. Who do they want? And the starting point would be, I would think, the Secretary of State to see if they nominate. And that would come through a court order.
And my question was not to the fact that lawyer would be asking to be the extent of the information that lawyer would have access to, since the House of Attorney statute allows for nominations inside the House of Attorney.
Well, I would think that the lawyer would be requesting the Secretary of State for both.
I would think so too.
on behalf of their protected person client. I mean, as you point out, lawyers do include those kinds of things and lots of other stuff in wills and directives and so forth. So I would think you want to be asking for what's in the secretary's file if you're going to represent this person. Well, there might be a petition filed, John, but whether it's resolved or not, there's going to be an appointment of counsel at the point of that petition. That lawyer then represents this person.
I just think it's very easy. You file your petition, you ask the court for a temporary order for limited purposes. If you ask the court for this temporary order, you're not necessarily making a permanent adjudication for persons impaired and is going to discharge them over the long term. I think both counsel have an interest in finding out the true facts. So if I was filing a petition, I might ask the court to appoint my client as a temporary guardian to get this limited information, or alternatively, to in an order allowing appointed counsel to do it. End of the discussion.
Well, it might be that the appointed counsel would find out that there's a supportive agreement that's been filed.
That's
a shame, too.
This is all there, so I'll go back to the Elder Protective Services received a report. Well, they might not make a request, so respond to a request to the attorney to provide that information. Their investigator is out there obtaining that information. They're going to go to that individual and say, hey, the person you were appointed to, you were designated, nominated to be their guardian is in the hospital. That person is going to come to the hospital and self-report to the hospital that they're person is in the hospital. I mean, you're creating networks, by just having that availability with the other professors.
And they can't disclose that, though. I mean, it's a misdemeanor to disclose it to anyone besides a very specific, anything Elder Protective Services, and hopefully in the next session, Adult Protective Services gathers in the course of their investigation. They're not, reaching out to people necessarily, they can't disclose it, but they can disclose to protect the person, they can do that, and then I guess genesis of my question was whether in the course of investigating supports for the individual, they could find out that information and find out whether they should or shouldn't be filing a petition to bring the public guardian. So that was the situation we have. Right?
It's not necessarily that they're disclosing that there's a report of abuse neglect exploitation or that they have filed to bring the Secretary of State's office. But just by doing their job, they're creating that network where that person is pulled in to the meeting. And then by virtue of that, the hospital gets contacted by that individual who has been informed that this person is needed their help. For instance, if Guardianship Services and that were nominated, and we didn't know that person was in the hospital, but the hospital notified EPS that they had this person who needs help. EPS checked the records and said, oh, thanks. And they called EPS and said, do you know this person's in the hospital? No. I go to the hospital. I'm here.
Well, but I think that's a violation of what they can disclose to you. So,
under the power of attorney statute, for example, a power of attorney could, that's active, could communicate with Elder Protective Services on the behalf. The mere nomination of someone is not like a concluded act. Whereas the power of attorney that's in effect, that individual is the proxy, versus being aware that there's a nomination out there that will someday take effect if it gets taken to the court. The nomination, I think, has no legal effect until that nominated individual
and power of attorney
there may be duplicate coverage, and that's why my interest was in these additional documents that might be included. If we have not been able to locate a power of attorney form, we may be able to then locate based on, there's documents left, let's go talk to maybe who filed it or some other individual to locate the power of attorney. So you're correct that, it's a multi-factor church, and, you know, I think that it's an important discussion to have offline. I did get Mr. Anderson's card. The issue with his agency and DDR is that they're limited for us as well. We were putting in ours for agent services as well. So we were discussing maybe allowing their request to piggyback on something that's conceptually similar that's already come out of committee. The Department of Treasury got a DDR through a subcommittee, an interim committee regarding adjusting the ABLE account registration. We may be able to conceptually do another cleanup within the same one. So I'll get in touch with him, and then obviously update the commission if we find any other ways to continue to have the discussion, because I think it's important for the right people to have information. It's important to protect the privacy of these individuals. That's really, really crucial. Maybe they pick someone and they don't want other families to know that they pick somebody. A lot of estate planning is about privacy, and so that's the balance I think the prior commission was trying to take into account. So I think they're all really, really good things to consider.
Can I ask one process question from one of the non-lawyers? Is the knowledge of having a guardian appointed helping? Is the knowledge that a guardian was appointed? So we can ask, they say they don't read their documents to go in the lockbox, which makes sense. Is there a way to add another step that just says, in these documents, did you appoint a guardian, yes or no? Could you have that information available, a yes or a no? Or is that still very confidential?
Still very confidential to the protection person, and I think Holder touched on a very important point that came out in the last committee about this, which was a protected person will select someone and they may not want other family members to be aware of it. There's very good reasons for the confidentiality of that nomination. That's why access was what it is to the court and to law enforcement, essentially.
So even without the rule being given, a yes or a no is still very
helpful. Sure, of course.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, well, this discussion will continue at a future point. Neil, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it. Nice seeing you again. And thanks for all of your help in implementing this effort. Scott and his colleagues had to go to another meeting, but I think we got the information from the Secretary's office, so thank you very much. You're welcome to stay if you want to debate other guardianship issues. I doubt that. So, okay, so if we could, let's move forward to, I've kind of covered agenda item 5 on the public hearing, so let's move forward over to rules and Dania and John, if you would like to divide them up or I would like to approach your report here, that would be great. I do want to preface the report with this concern of the chair of the commission. About a month ago, Dania and John gave me a pretty substantial breakdown, which they're going to discuss a little bit today, of pending rules. I recognize that people are busy, but I am very concerned that there's been some rules that have been pending for too long, the draft of which have been pending too long. So one of the things that John and Danny and I discussed is the rules that are pending and getting these things accomplished. So I was originally going to send an email to the subcommittee saying to folks, if you can't work on this, stop being on the committee. I'm going to appoint somebody else to get the job done. So what I'm going to request is kind of a restart on some of the remaining rules. If you are on that committee and you have an assigned responsibility to draft a rule and you don't feel you can get it done in the next month, we need to know that out of respect to the commission and the subcommittee so we can get somebody else who will come in and get the job done. No apology necessary. I know people are busy, but we got to get this completed. So if you can't get it done, just tell us, be truthful and fail, but move on to other people who promise that they would get it done. That said, Kenya, John, where are we at? And then we'll send an email after this meeting to the members of the subcommittee and say, this is our understanding of the rules you're going to draft. If you can't get them done in the next month, please tell us, and tell us now. Fair enough?
This is Kenya. John, do you want me to take this guide initially, or would you like to wait?
No, that's fine. And actually, are we going to these proposed rules, and I am taking the proposed to what I have done what I'm taking?
Well,
that would be you take the lead. Go ahead.
Alright, let me dive in here and you can put up the guardrails as necessary. Thank you, Justice Hartsey. Justice Hartsey is correct. Tom and I recognize that the six approved rules do not hold a candle to the work that was done by the Corn Committee. And we also recognize that rule drafting is very difficult in terms of trying to determine what should be done and how to do it in conjunction with legislation and how not to essentially serve the legislative role. So we have put a lot of thought into how this information is getting processed and what the committee is, that committee is trying to do. In that regard, we were able to generate six rules which the commission approved and have been sent to the Supreme Court. However, as Justice Hartsey indicated, there is a list that we put together for Justice Hartsey's review prior to this meeting that demonstrates some work in progress. And so what I can do is review that a little bit, and then we can also look at the agenda where there are other rules set forth in ABK and the ABKT, and what I will, what comment I will make in regard to the agenda and the rules there. The subcommittee hasn't vetted these rules yet or determined whether or not the subcommittee would advise that all of these rules be pursued. Some of them you will see are works in progress. Others, I know I have questions about. I'm not sure what the genesis of them was in original commission. I tried to find background information on some of them and I couldn't. So I think that's something maybe we'd like to discuss as a subcommittee before we advance that to the commission for further review of what we think should happen. With that said, some rules that are currently outstanding. One is the filing of personal information in bargaining cases. That there was a rule that was originally drafted. By mixing, the representation was that the final redraft will be submitted to the subcommittee by April 11th. That hasn't been done. We aren't sure of the status of that. I think, John, is that one of the rules that your most recent email refers to?
Yes.
Okay, so that appears to be in progress. John, do you want to elaborate on that now, or do you want me to finish the list first? I think another issue we're working on in the committee were rules regarding telephonic appearances, and John, I think that one was with you. I'm not sure where that lies. Elizabeth Birchfield was working on a noticing rule. That's asked to the discussion committee on March 28th. I think, though, John, you have obtained that. We didn't have it circulated in. Am I correct about that? Draft is due to the subcommittee on April 11th, and again, that's another one that seems to have fallen off the radar. McQueen was working on a draft rule for garden ad litem, which is also due to the subcommittee on April 11th. The status of that rule is unknown. And McQueen was also working on rules regarding attorneys for protected persons. Draft of which is due to the subcommittee on April 11th, and the status of that is unknown. I will represent, I know Mr. Keene is not here, I do see him periodically in court, and he has mentioned that he knows that these are out there, but as yet incomplete. So we may need to circle back around, Mr. Keene. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think Mr. Birchfield has it.
I've reached out to Daniel and Don and Vic, and I just want to offer my services. If there's any need for assistance in drafting any rules related to the appointment of counsel or the role of counsel, we have obviously everybody done a lot of research on the topic to put our program together, and I would be happy to participate in all that I can.
And thank you so much, and I expect your offer to advance any sort of draft to our subcommittee with John's agreement. We need subject matter experts in these areas, and that's part of it, is not just identifying what needs to be written, but identifying the people who have maybe a little bit of subject matter expertise to really be able to work a rule that addresses the problem. Another outstanding rule relates to AB 264, and I believe this has something to do with trust. This was being drafted by Judge Young and Donnell Christensen. Ms. Christensen is no longer a member of the commission. This rule was represented a variety of times that it was completed, but this, or close to, but this had to be submitted to the subcommittee, and the subcommittee did not receive a rule in that regard, so I don't know the status of that. Mallory Nelson, are you still drafting or intending to draft a rule regarding termination of guardianships and revocations of letters for noncompliance?
That's correct.
Okay.
I was supporting Mallory on that. I think that some of the confusion was that at different stages of the process, people represented subject matter interests, and then we weren't sure about the priority of rules, whether they were deep dives and we should be doing big picture situations. I believe that was the case with the Young rule that you just mentioned before. I have, I think, an email thread where I believe they thought maybe it had been abandoned in favor of waiting until the statutory numbering came out, because I think that that was something that was difficult for the Rules Committee to handle when we were relying, you know. So, I mean, I'm not making excuses. I've just been mentioning that I had a call with Deborah Lookout from Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada recently about the termination issue, because it raises a lot of questions that we're worried have to be dealt with legislatively, because if a guardian is removed, does that person then continue to have counsel? Does the guardianship continue in some way? Do they need a restoration of right? Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada's position is the guardianship is over. They don't need a formal restoration of right. The difficulty we're facing is that hospitals and dentists say we have an adjudication of the person is incapacitated. You know, so there's been robust discussion about it being
a need, and the rule may not be the right tool because there is no answer in the statute that's consistent. So I think that's where we're at on that.
I think part of what needs to happen overall as a subcommittee is we need to reconstitute, who is going to participate, and then we review as a subcommittee where all these are. And it will be much as a implementation readiness protocol that some of these ideas for rules, the conclusion is, look, this is not a subject appropriately delegated to rulemaking. It is something that is more in the legislative wheelhouse. And I think the problem that we're having is we're just sort of dropping off and we're not communicating as a subcommittee. So we really need to get that back on track. And then I think you can see that some of those are cross-referenced with what's in the agenda. And so what we need to do is regroup and really get people to take a look at maybe what's in the agenda or what rules we talked about and think about, like Mr. Virchow did. Okay, this is my skill set. I can contribute to the drafting of this rule. Some of the ones that are on the agenda talk about rules regarding court supervision. Those probably should come from court personnel. So those are kind of my general comments in terms of our status, but I think the first thing we need to do is figure out, kind of take a poll and figure out with the Part C assistant who is on our subcommittee, and then maybe we can most likely with the coach assistant send out one of those emails that say, what meeting dates are best for you, and kind of regroup in terms of going forward, because the year is moving on and we're going to be coming up on a new legislative session. And so depending on what we're able to do with rules might influence what gets looked at legislatively. John, would you put up some guardrails on the statement?
I echo what Danny said, that obviously it's the job of our committee to do some of the changes. So some of it probably would further develop in the subcommittee and before we take whole committee time. But I would appreciate a little guidance if I could. One issue I know there was something you mentioned about telephonic appearance. In some court hearings by doing everyone a favor, because the statute talks about that if the person can't appear, and let's say that for medical reason, it would be over the burden of them in the court. So we wanted to participate, so the statute talks about a video appearance. But several of the courtrooms can't handle a video. It's like a logistical problem to do that. And so we had, in some cases, arranged to do a telephonic appearance. I just wondered how the judges feel about that. If we can't do the video, do we just say they can't appear? And what would be the best way? Or do you want to have a rule that I don't know if I'm making legislation here, but the thought was, can we say that an audio, a telephonic appearance is similar with a video appearance in the statute? Anyone have any comments on that?
On my regards, I would like to see the minors in person or at least by video, but not by telephone.
I can understand that because you're not seeing them, I guess, it's different.
This is
so
I'm sorry, John. In several of my courts in Northern Nevada, we're already allowing people to attend by telephone, mostly family members from out of state, but I do have some cases on annual accounting where those protected persons are placed out of state, and there would be no way for them to attend the hearing except for by telephonic appearance. So the courts have just been by judicial acceptance been allowing that. I didn't know that. That's a procedural item, I believe, and it's probably something that we could handle by rule.
So there's telephonic appearance of other parties and family members, and that's important as well. I was talking about telephonic appearance of the proposed protected person.
In the initial hearing?
Yeah.
That rarely happens. So I guess it does, and some other people have those situations.
So John, maybe refer you to the Supreme Court rule
which and the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure, both of which apply to guardianship proceedings. The Supreme Court rules in particular clarify that audio transmission, be it by video or by telephone, is something that is within the discretion of the judge, but the rule itself says that that shall be allowed unless the judge finds an exception against doing so. It's the opposite of what some have approached under, I believe, it's Rule 24. So I would think that if one is in that situation, you'd make a motion under the Supreme Court rule. There's a separate set of rules that were incorporated within the Supreme Court rule, following the work of a committee chaired by Justice Givens. It's been on the books now for probably 12 years at least, apparently not something that is widely known to the bench or bar, because the court has recently published an opinion, and I say recently, I think last week or 2 weeks ago, in the case of LaBarbera, which addresses this very point. And it was a case in which the judge refused to allow someone from Italy to participate in their own trial by telephonic communication. Yes, you have to put in appropriate protections. That's part of the rule. So you have to be able to appropriately identify the person who wishes to participate by telephonic communication. And so those mechanisms have to be part of the conversation with the judge. But the rule mandates audio transmission unless there are reasons, exceptions, or prejudices that will result from not doing so. So I think that I would refer the judges, even in the guardianship context, to that new published opinion, even though that case dealt with a civil jury trial that resulted in a $2.6 million verdict and has now been reversed because of the judge's refusal to allow the defendant to participate by audio transmission from Italy. I don't know if that's helpful, but you might want to take a look at that. And it references the rule I'm talking about.
Okay. Take a look at that. Did you want me, would you have to get one to briefly address presumptively confidential information, or do you want to save on that, circulate materials, and how do I get to approach that?
Well, my personal preference is that you're questioning that it's, from the emails I've seen, there seems to be divergent views. Maybe you come to an agreement and you come back to the committee with a dissent. This is another thing that I've seen, and it comes up in every committee and commission I've ever served on. People rightfully have different points of view, and sometimes you can't always agree. So there needs to be a majority and a dissent. We see that every day on the Supreme Court. So if your committee has a majority and there are other, maybe there are three views, I don't know. But when you reach an impasse, don't let the impasse prevent the work from going forward. Bring it to the committee and we'll break the impasse. But what frustrates me is a lot of these rules committees, not necessarily this one, but others in other contexts, they get stalled and they don't get their work done because they're debating the same damn point that they debated in the last meeting and the five meetings before that. Take a vote, move forward. Otherwise, you don't get these things resolved. So take a vote. And if you have divergent views, present them all to the committee.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. We're able actually to successfully do that with the ex parte rule that is now before the court for approval. So
It is a worthy process.
Yeah. And I know that it's a healthy, the value of the subcommittee is to really get in the weeds, going back to Homer's point. Yeah, we want you to get in the weeds. But here's the urgency. If the committee, in looking at this, finds that this is really something that requires legislative change or addition, we got to move. The calendar's moving up on us, and we don't have any PDRs. So we're going to have to go out and find legislators, or like I deferred to the Secretary of State's office a few minutes ago, we need to find DDRs to carry this legislation. So a lot has to happen, and the legislators themselves are under limitations on when they can submit their DDRs, as you all know. So the time crunch is upon us.
So, Mayor, I know we have Senator Harris on the commission, and certain legislative representatives have DDRs. Has there been any inspiration of filling her position with another legislator at this point?
Multiple legislators, but many of them are up for election, so we kind of got to wait till after November volatile as politics is, I don't know that anybody can say for sure someone's coming back unless they're already an incumbent.
Thank you.
So we've reached out to several legislators, and frankly, several legislators have told me, what does this commission need? What's their interest? There's a lot of legislators on both sides of the aisle who are very motivated and highly interested in this topic, and want to be supportive of recommendations that come from this group. But they don't want to go do some legislation that can be also handled by rules. So that's the importance of the rules committee. If you can get it handled by rules, I think that's everybody's problem. Okay, so anything further, John or Danny, at this juncture?
Seems like, Your Honor, you can just pick you up on what I believe is your offer to circulate the question of interest and really see where we are with our membership, and then we can proceed to get on the back on track.
Okay, we'll get that done. Okay, let's take a brief recess. I hope there's lunch in Las Vegas. I don't know if it's been delivered, but I'm hopeful that that's the case, and there has been lunch delivered up here. So if everybody would collect your lunch and come back in, let's say, 15 minutes, if that's reasonable, to get going again on this legislative topic. Okay?
So,
also a good thing about data. I don't know that it's not that I don't think that you can look at the
I know what I learned.